cocktails. Are you right here?
We're going to do Clausen and then have
okay.
So grab the
Good afternoon, everyone. This is the Committee on Health, Human Services, and Housing. It is Wednesday, March 19th. We have a very long agenda. We plan to reconvene at 6 in room 15 if the agenda is not completed during this afternoon's hearing. Because we have accommodated to so many of the author's requests to have hearings, and because we want to be respectful of that request, we're asking the authors of the bills who are being presented to be succinct in describing the bills that you're presenting, to be succinct in focusing us specifically on the policy issues of concern to this committee, and we're asking that there be only one, at the most, two very brief presentations from testifiers. We want the testifiers, if you're here to testify on a bill, to understand that your focus should be on the policy issues of concern in this committee and be focused and succinct to that. Sometimes people come to these committees with long testimonies written out and prepared. If you have long written testimonies, please review those now and adjust them so that they can be synthesized to the critical points. We will not allow the hearings to go on and on because we're trying to accommodate to many bills, and if we can't get through them expediently, we'll lay them on the table and possibly take them up at a later date today. Senator Stump is here, so we're going to begin with Senate File 2026, which is a bill requesting a moratorium exception authorization for Thief River Falls Psychiatric Hospital construction. Welcome to the committee, Senator Stumpf, and please begin your testimony. I don't know if your testifiers heard my request to stay focused and to the point of the policies that this committee has concern about in the bill. We have a long agenda, and we're wanting to move as quickly as possible through that.
Thank you, Senator Stump. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And committee members, when I look at that stack of bills that you have, I totally
could
understand.
Could you pull your microphone up just a little bit? In the audience, please be careful about your conversations. Take them into the hall. We have a great deal of time, a difficult time hearing in this room.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. This is a very important bill for northwestern Minnesota, but I believe for the whole state. It's an opportunity that we have in my area for helping provide some additional beds, psychiatric beds, and at the same time, we have Sanford Health, who is also building a new hospital in our area. So Thief River Falls area is going to be the benefactor in the whole region in northwestern Minnesota of some of these opportunities that are occurring right now. I think to keep the testimony as short as possible, I'd like to introduce Brian Carlson, who is the CEO of Sanford Hospital in Thief River Falls. And I think Brian and Casey Johnson, the CFO from the Sanford Hospital, can frame out the what we'd like to achieve and also we have a map, a visual that we'll show you once they do some testimony of our area there. So, Brian.
Madam Chair.
Welcome, Mr. Carlson. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Good afternoon. My name is Brian Carlson. I'm the Chief Executive Officer for Sanford Thief River Falls Medical Center in Thief River Falls. We had several individuals lined up for testimony today, but out of respect for the time constraints of this committee, we did not ask them to appear. So there is a handout coming around to you, and the last page of that handout does contain a list of supporters for the bill, and many of whom would have been here had time allowed. Healthcare, is at a precipice on many fronts today, not the least of which is the provision of behavioral health services, particularly in rural communities. Today I want to provide some background information about our vision and strategy to improve access to and the provision of appropriate behavioral health services and how our bill will support this vision. Thief River Falls is a critical access hospital operating 25 acute care beds and an additional 10 beds as a distinct part inpatient psychiatric unit as permitted under federal regulation. Unfortunately, being a critical access hospital, we are limited by federal law to operating no more than 10 beds for inpatient psychiatric services, which, as you will hear soon, falls far short of the need in northwestern Minnesota. In addition to our existing inpatient psychiatric unit, Thief River Falls provides a full continuum of step-down services for continued care of our behavioral health patients upon discharge from their inpatient stay. Services such as community-based residential services, both adolescent and adult discrete facilities, crisis and stabilization services, case management and rehabilitative services, which includes animal-assisted therapies, both canine and equine. Our providers include 3 psychiatrists, 10 PhD-level psychologists, and specially trained nurses, social workers, and care techs with skill sets necessary to care for our patients, whether inpatient or outpatient. Our vision for northwestern Minnesota is to grow into a regional hub, providing the most comprehensive level of behavioral health services, a full continuum of care spanning both acute inpatient needs as well as outpatient services, providing care in the most economical and efficient setting designed to meet each individual's needs. We all know that that medical services of any kind provided on an inpatient basis are going to be more expensive than in an outpatient setting. In Thief River Falls, we have been working very hard to reduce medical costs and have been extremely successful in behavioral health, reducing the average length of stay of our inpatient psychiatric population from 8.5 days to 6 over the last 5 years, which is a 31% reduction in inpatient stay. We have been able to accomplish this through the development and growth of our outpatient services, again providing a full continuum of behavioral health services for northwestern Minnesota, which is unmatched by any other provider in our region. I would now ask that my colleague Casey Johnson address some of the demographic and demand studies that we've completed in support of this bill. Thank you.
I think, Madam Chair, now is when I'll show our visual.
Thank you, Senator Stump.
Madam Chair, Casey Johnson, CFO at Sanford Health in Thief River Falls. What Mark is holding up is a map of Minnesota where we've carved out what we're kind of redefining as what our primary service area will be. Kind of goes across from Polk to Mahnomen County, Beltrami County, straight north to the border. For all these counties, we already serve, more than 35% in each individual county of the psychiatric diagnoses. In many counties, it's much higher than that. But basically, we're kind of trying to illustrate the demand here. Thief River Falls, I can't see it, but hopefully you can, is the far, upper left dot there, and that's where we're located. That area encompasses a population of about 150,000 people. The rate of admission in that service area is about 30% less than the average rate of admission for psychiatric diagnoses throughout the state. And obviously with the moratorium legislation seeking an exception to that, the primary question is probably, is there a real need? Is there real demand? From our point of view, there is, and the rate of incident of admission is part of that. We also have documented over one calendar year, we had about 350 turnaways based on the fact that we were either at capacity or had one available bed and perhaps a planned admission for the near future, and we had to turn away about 350 admissions in one calendar year. We only admit about 470 patients in a calendar year, so that kind of shows you, the need from our region that we're not able to meet currently. The highest origin of turnaway was Beltrami County, but the second highest was St. Louis County, which is the Duluth area. And so you can see we're about 4.5 hours away on Highway 2 from Duluth, and we're turning away a good number of patients from Duluth that don't have access in that region. And that kind of illustrates the dependency of the entire state system on these beds. And there was a story yesterday in the Star Tribune that outlined kind of the interdependency of the demand for psychiatric inpatient services in all the beds in the state, with another closing announced at Riverwood recently. In addition to that, we have letters of support from basically every hospital provider in that primary service area that you've seen there. We see a lot of referrals from their emergency rooms. We also have letters of support from every social service director in those counties. In addition, we have some surrounding counties that have also authored letters of support for those services. So we don't think the demand is artificial or being driven by our own providers for our own financial incentive. We think there's real demand issues out there. The second question, and I'll try and be brief, is, are we putting our resources into the right area on the continuum of behavioral health care? We also offer residential services, in-home services, and a wide variety of outpatient services to folks who suffer with mental and behavioral health issues. We're not just an inpatient center. As Brian mentioned, we have several outpatient providers, but we also have a vast array of mental health practitioners and a number of rehabilitative services offered in that regard. So we understand the value and the relevance of some of the more outpatient or home-based preventative services, and we've invested in those as well, but we still see a need to keep people in Northwest Minnesota, because a lot of times if we don't have access, they might end up at Anoka or places beyond, and when that happens, it's harder for those people to get back into a residential setting or back to their home where they can be supported, because we're integrated with those services in greater Northwest Minnesota, where it's harder for a place like Anoka to place somebody back into, let's say, Roseau, Minnesota, and have working knowledge and working relationships with the people who might deliver, that lower cost, more rehabilitative, preventative care. So we, kind of in short, we feel like the need is there, and by keeping people in Northwest Minnesota, we're keeping them closer to the services that will provide better outcomes in the long run and more cost-effective care in the long run.
Thank you. Yep. Senator, I didn't mean to interrupt you if you were not finished. No. Senator Stump.
Madam Chair, I think one point on that map, that service area that was highlighted with a dark blue line, was Bemidji. And Bemidji's right close to that, but there, services that are provided there, I believe, are primarily for seniors. Is that correct?
Correct. They have geropsych, and there is also a CBHH facility in the Bemidji area, which is typically at capacity and can't accept individuals.
Thank you. Is there anything further that you wish to articulate? Did you want to go through anything specific within the language of the bill?
Madam Chair, I don't think so.
Madam Chair, I would like to just explain a couple things. That the reason for the language in the bill, we are a critical access hospital that operates a 10-bed distinct part unit. In order to offer more than 10 beds for psychiatric services, we need to essentially spin off the psychiatric unit into its own specialty hospital. And so even though we operate 10 beds today, and that's where we're getting a lot of this data is from our internal operations, we can't just transfer bed licenses from the critical access hospital to the newly formed hospital. So if we want 25 beds, we have to ask for 25 bed licenses, even though we operate 10 now. That's the reason it's asking for 10 or 25.
And to keep your federally qualified or critical access status, you need to have no more than 10 beds. Is that correct?
Right. So that's why we have to spin off.
Okay.
The other point that some time ago, a neighboring community that had some psychiatric beds closed in the Crookston area, and so those are gone, and I believe that was 25 beds.
Well, actually, they weren't psychiatric beds, and we've gotten some questions from the Department of Health on this too. They weren't psychiatric beds; they were chemical dependency and detox beds. The point that we made in the public interest review was when those beds went away, we still saw an increased volume because a lot of these patients are dealing with chemical dependency issues as well as, like, you know, they have psychiatric diagnoses as well. And so if that detox center or that chemical dependency bed is no longer available in the region, they're going to hold people in the ER until they're BAC is down below 0.08, and then they can get into Thief River Psych Unit. So we're seeing more stress because of that, even though it's not exactly psychiatric beds closing in the region. It is a resource that went away that is kind of stressing out emergency rooms and our facility, you know, across the Northwest Minnesota region.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. We have Benjamin Wortman, who is the wanting to testify as well. But before you do, Mr. Wortman, and before you leave, just to give a sense of order here, I think that I'm going to open it for questions to these testifiers at this time if anybody wishes to ask these testifiers any questions. We also would like to hear from the department as well on what the status is of their review of the needs assessment as it relates to this project. So I'm hoping someone's here to speak to that. And so with that, are there any questions from the committee for these testifiers at this time? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Casey or Mr. Carlson, I find it amazing, actually, Madam Chair, about the moratorium that we have in place, especially when there is such a great need. And I remember working on the children's psychiatric beds up in Maple Grove, and that was such a struggle to get to it. And I'm just amazed at your figures that you've turned away over 300 and some odd people in a year's time to go find some other beds at other places, and, of course, your distance. Are you getting much... are you getting people from across in North Dakota? Are there services in that area?
Are you, Madam Chair?
Yes, Mr. Carlson.
Are you asking if
Mr. Johnson?
We see patients from North Dakota, or we send patients to North Dakota, or both?
Both.
Madam Chair,
Mr. Johnson, go ahead.
Sorry. We do see some patients from North Dakota, and some patients do cross borders. It makes it difficult because a lot of the need is in the area of, you know, people who are civilly committed or placed on 72-hour holds. And a lot of times it's difficult contractually to cross state borders in those cases. So in a lot of cases, you know, they're left to kind of find resources within the state. And that's what makes it difficult. And it's difficult for other facilities too. Anoka, you know, has issues, and you can't just send them elsewhere a lot of times because the states kind of have these closed, you know, systems in some respects.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other questions at this time? Then we will proceed. Is Mr. Wortman available? Please come forward, introduce yourself. Perhaps someone could offer a chair and stay available, though, for questions if it is necessary later.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ben Ashley Wortman, and I am the Policy and Outreach Associate for the Mental Health Association of Minnesota. This spring, we're celebrating 75 years of being a guiding light for Minnesotans with mental illnesses. We have significant concerns about addressing issues with the availability of inpatient beds by adding to the system. When we add capacity but do not resolve systemic issues of demand and discharge settings, we end up back where we started. We understand that this project does need to have consideration under the MDH report, and until that comes back, we have some, you know, issues left in the air. But as you're doing so, we ask that you consider the following concerns with inpatient patient flow and availability. The IMD exclusion is a significant barrier for this project. A 25-unit independent psychiatric facility without further division will be excluded from federal participation funding. We have heard that 25 is the space available and that it's economically feasible for the hospital, but we will need significant detail about how this proposal will avoid that exclusion. Many adults living with mental illnesses are newly eligible for MA, and so right now they're carrying 100% federal participation. We are concerned about the financial impact of the project as described. Secondly, many of the patient flow issues for adult psychiatric hospital care are laid out in the DHS report in response to the OLA study for state-operated services. We worked hard to get this information in front of policymakers, and one of the key problems identified is a lack of adequate and coordinated community services to support individuals' recovery in their communities. Right now, too many people are stuck in Anoka long past their need to be there. Other people have been discharged to, frankly, inappropriate settings, including homeless shelters. The bottleneck issues in Anoka, the underutilization of the CBHHs, this pushes all the way through the system and causes problems for all inpatient settings across the state. Providing access to hospital beds is more about community settings and availability than capacity and construction. Inpatient care comes at a very high cost, over $1,000 a day for private pay or for Anoka. It is an absolutely necessary part of the system, but we cannot afford the human or financial costs of underproviding the community services that allow for discharge and prevention. ARMS, for instance, bills around $80 a day, ERTS $250. These are services that have significant effects on hospitalization rate. We've taken some really tough cuts in community services, and the Mental Health Association of Minnesota is strongly in favor of reinvesting there first. Thank you for your time.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Wortman. Are there any questions at this time? From members of the committee, for Mr. Wortman. Senator Lurie.
Madam Chair, maybe not for Mr. Wortman, but maybe Mr. Carlson or Mr. Johnson could respond to Mr. Wortman and talk about the availability of Medicaid funding if you go above the 16-bed IMD. I think you would be for closing the opportunity of getting funded by Medicaid, and I think, as he indicated, there, you know, that could be a substantial portion of your patients that you would see, and I'm just wanting to make sure you know, think you can operate without that.
Madam Chair,
Mr. Carlson,
Senator Lurie, I'd be happy to respond to those comments. As far as the IMD exclusion, that's a federal Medicaid exclusion. We're well aware of the gap in terms of age grouping that the exclusion pertains to. So if you are an institution of mental disease, have greater than 16 beds, we would be excluded from payment for individuals receiving treatment between the ages of 21 and 65. We have no intention of becoming an IMD. The request for 25 bed licenses, in addition to the space currently being available and very economically being able to be rehabbed, would permit us the opportunity to have 16 beds for psychiatric services. And the remaining 9 beds is something that we're working out with the Department of Health or will be discussing with them for possible provision of services as an inpatient chemical dependency detox center. With the closure in Crookston of the Glenmore facility, the facility that Mr. Johnson referenced earlier in his comments, there are no inpatient chemical detox facilities within a reasonable distance of Thief River Falls and even within the Crookston area. So we are evaluating those additional 9 beds as possibly becoming inpatient detox beds.
Senator Lurie?
Madam Chair, I think we did probably have to figure that out before we were to pass this law, because the language calls for a 25-bed psych hospital, which would make it very difficult to negotiate with the feds to try to argue that you were not an IMD if we were to pass this law and you proceeded to construct a 25-bed psych hospital. So we should probably work on that as we move forward and make the language match what might work.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions from the committee members at this time?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Mr. Carlson.
I have one more comment. The region that we provide services, northwestern Minnesota, and I want to reiterate from my earlier comments, We provide a full continuum of behavioral health services, which is something that is not readily available in other areas of the state. The length of stay of our patients, as I indicated, has dropped from 8.5 days to 6. We are an acute care facility, and acute by definition is a short stay facility. We're not a long-term care. We're not interested in retaining individuals in an inpatient status any longer than necessary and refer them to our outpatient services as quickly as possible. And that is our intention. The fact that we're not meeting almost 100% again the need that we are able to admit by not having capacity is, by allowing us the 16 beds for psychiatric services will allow us to meet that inpatient need and then move them along to a more appropriate care setting in a less costly environment.
Thank you. Ms. Abderholden would like to speak, and then is there someone here from the Department of Health? Would you please come forward at this time? Mr. Carlson, could you give him a space at the table, but please remain available for questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Sue Abderholden with NAMI Minnesota. I just want to put out there our board has not yet taken a position on this bill, but does have some questions. Of all the people in this room, I can tell you I understand the need for mental health services probably more than anyone. We do know we have a front door and a back door issue. We want to prevent hospitalizations as much as possible and prevent people from returning it. We are more questioning the model. Moving to freestanding psychiatric hospitals does create problems in terms of the IMD exclusion. But also, I want to remind you that our community behavioral health hospitals have not been at their peak capacity. And part of the problem is they can't take people who have severe aggression because you don't have enough staff to be able to respond immediately. And so those folks are the ones that are not put in our CBHHs. And also people who might have a co-occurring healthcare condition, whether it's a problem with diabetes or heart disease or something else, it also makes it hard to do in a freestanding. So I just want to put that out to you that we also need to think about the model to make sure that we're really meeting the needs of people in the future. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Welcome. Please introduce yourself and who you're representing and begin your testimony.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Stefan Gildemeister. I direct the health economics program in the Department of Health, and it's our group that typically conducts the required public interest review under chapters 144-552. So I'm happy to answer any questions that you have on the process or more generally or where we are with the review of this proposal before you.
Thank you. Would you please indicate to us where you're at in terms of that review process?
Madam Chair, happy to. So we have received the plan underlying the request for an exception in early February. We've gone back to the facility and their staff with a series of questions. We've received the response still in February, and we have begun our review at the beginning of March. We've communicated that to folks at Thief River Falls. Technically speaking, you expect from us to conduct a thoughtful and thorough review, and you've given us 3 months to do that. We are working very hard at trying to make available information to the legislature should you be interested in some preliminary findings in early in April. But I have to say I'm a little bit anxious around offering that because we really want to be sure that we can conduct the kind of thoughtful analysis that you expect from us.
Thank you. Are there any questions? So if I were to summarize that, you will be giving us a preliminary indication of what you think the general trend will be for what your findings are as you do the needs assessment. And by the mid-April, did you say early April? April 1st?
I would go with what you offered up first. Mid-April seems more realistic.
But that you will, that doesn't stop the process, that you'll continue to do a more thorough and complete assessment of that process. Can you tell me, is that early indicator a good predictor?
Madam Chair, this is a we are stepping into new lands here. We have typically not done that, and I can't speak yet to what our findings will be. So I really am not sure that I can say whether it's a good indicator or not. I think at the time you'll have a good sense whether it's a good indicator or not, because it'll come with probably some limitations and some concerns that we might be raising, and also with sort of an indication of what additional work we feel is necessary to do. But yes, we'll by then we'll have conducted some quantitative analysis. We will have hopefully heard additional responses from affected hospitals, and we would have done some policy analysis sort of to lay out the context. Madam Chair, I would remind you that ultimately the decision, of course, rests with the legislature, so you are free to ignore our recommendations as well as our early signs, although I hope the strength of our recommendations would inform your decisions.
Thank you, and of course we are aware that we can ignore that, but the policy that was established for establishing moratorium on inpatient psychiatric beds had with it a general sense of direction of trying to strengthen the community-based resources and services that help people be diverted from the more costly kind of care, increasing crisis intervention, in-home visiting, a whole range of services that are a part of what this proposal and this center has provided in this region before. So, you know, I'm inclined to not throw out with each request the process of trying to understand how this fits the overall goals and model of the state as it relates to the mental health system. Having said that, Mr. Carlson, if it was possible for us to establish a condition that the this process, should we make this decision and sort of move through finance, that it be conditioned on the outcomes and the recommendations and the negotiations with the department about because what I heard you say is that there oftentimes is not just that it move forward if that was the recommendation, but that you might modify or make some suggested changes based on the analysis that you've done. And so I'm wondering how we can incorporate a commitment to working with that in this legislation. Do you have a reaction to that, Mr. Carlson?
Madam Chair, we would be more than happy to work with the Department of Health, with Sue, and can't forget his name, the previous testifier.
You know, Mr. Wortman?
Wortman, yes, mm-hmm. Thank you. Work with their organizations as well in, you know, designing and crafting the services that we are able to provide in Thief River. We'd be more than happy to.
Thank you.
Madam Chair,
Senator Stump.
I think I would also add to that I think the language change that Senator Lurie had pointed out, that we can start looking at right away too, to be sure that reflects the intent and scope of what Sanford is looking for.
So, Senator Stumpf, that sounds like you will be working on some language to address those issues about the beds that are psychiatric beds and the beds that are chemical dependency or detoxification beds, and perhaps some language that relates, that makes a commitment to working with the department as it moves forward. And I'll be thinking about how to articulate that because I'm on the committee at finance as well. Are there other questions? Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question I have is, how do you expect that this facility will function better than the current CBHHs that are at best functioning moderately, but with the issues that Sue Aberholden brought up? And I mean, I have had many coworkers and nurses who've worked in them where if you have somebody who is acutely ill, and striking out, you don't have enough staff to protect anybody. And there have been some serious issues. And I don't know how, if there's been any plan around addressing some of that, or, I don't know why you would be more successful than the state, is what I'm asking.
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair and Senator Eaton, I did want to respond to Sue's comments in terms of staffing, which gets to your question as well, I believe. As I indicated in my earlier comments, we do have a significant number of professional providers, physicians and PhD psychologists that we already employ. Three psychiatrists in a community the size of Thief River Falls is virtually unheard of. We've aggressively recruited those individuals to increase the type of services we can provide and to support further expansion throughout northwestern Minnesota. The 10 psychologists that we have as well, and then specialty trained staff dealing with inpatients as well as outpatient setting, also enables us to provide more care and better care for those individuals. We have not had issue, at least to this point in time, in attracting staff and recruiting staff to meet the needs in our respective areas, whether it's inpatient or outpatient services. We also have in our facility, we have fully integrated our behavioral health services with our primary care services. And by that I mean, as is typically the case, when a patient is seen in a behavioral health setting, oftentimes the issue at hand is being dealt with in terms of their behavioral issues, but they may also have an accompanying medical condition, which is contributing to the mental issues as well. We have referrals established and a system established with our family practice physicians, our internal medicine physicians, and our obstetrical physicians that they freely move patients between the continuum of care services that we have, making referrals for behavioral health visits if they deem it appropriate, and vice versa, the behavioral health physicians and psychologists refer to our primary care physicians to address medical issues that might be contributing factors as well. And I think that's a process that you won't see in the state systems that we have available in Thief River Falls and have worked very hard to develop that pathway for care.
Is there any more discussion? Senator Rosen?
Madam Chair, just for the record, I don't think people are very familiar with Sanford Health Systems. I, just from redistricting, have acquired a small portion of Sanford in my area. Of course, we're more in greater Minnesota, it's the Mayo system, but Sanford is top-notch. And I'm glad to hear your description of your integrating behavior health with your primary. That's the direction we need to go. And I appreciate, Madam Chair, your willingness to continue to work on this, because obviously there is a huge void that Sanford's willing to step up and fill. And I think we can get this right. So with that, Madam Chair, I'd like to move that Senate File 2026 be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Finance.
Finance. Senator Lurie.
Madam Chair, I'm going to support that motion, but one question. I don't know if you're able to answer this right now or not, but that maybe should be part of the conversation as we move forward, is of that 10-bed psychiatric unit today, what percentage is Medicaid? Because if it wound up to be an IMD and we foreclosed the option of Medicaid funding, mm-hmm. I worry about a system that doesn't allow our Medicaid clients, and particularly if they have a large percentage of the inpatient psych services that are offered currently. I mean, we could be creating a real gap, particularly as we're just getting to some of the best coverage for people with mental illness than we've seen ever. And so I'd hate to foreclose that. So if you don't have to answer that today, but as I'd like that to be part of the conversation.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Carlson.
Senator Lurie, I do know off the top of my head that we have a fairly even spectrum of payer mix for inpatient and behavioral health services. Right now, on the inpatient side, Medicaid represents about 28% of the patients coming to us in that particular unit. And the rest is evenly spread. I shouldn't say evenly spread, but the larger chunks would be Blue Cross and... Where's the other one? Blue Cross represents about 11%. Medicare is about 17.6%. And PMAP is about 11%. So in terms of Medicaid in particular, it's about 28% of the clients. Now, of those individuals that are being referred or turned away, I don't know what payer mix those would be, but my guess would be fairly similar to the distribution we see today.
The motion is, Senator Rosen's motion is to pass Senate File 2026 and refer to Finance. Is there any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Those opposed say nay. Motion passes. Thank you, Senator. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and committee members.
We are going to be skipping Senator Cohen's bill for now. It may be put on later this afternoon or perhaps this in the evening. Senator Cohen had to leave for other responsibilities. So, Senator Clausen, you ready? 1731, Civil Commitment Act Training Program Establishment and Appropriation. We were really falling behind, so I'm hoping that you heard me encourage you to get to the central points of the bill and what the policy issue is that brings you before us.
Very good. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members, and thank you for the opportunity to present Senate File 1731, a bill to establish a statewide online civil commitment training program. And I do have an A1 amendment I'd like to move.
Senator Senator Rosen offers the A1 amendment. Is there any questions or discussion on the amendment, this author's amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion passes.
Thank you,
Senator.
And as you can see, it's a very small amendment. It does include the Minnesota Hospital Association as a collaborator in developing the training module, and that's on line 17. There are two main purposes for the Minnesota Civil Commitment Act. The first is to treat persons with mental illness when they are unable or unwilling to seek treatment voluntarily. And secondly, to protect the person with mental illness and others from harm due to the illness. The civil commitment process can be confusing. It can be intimidating, emotional, and often viewed as a last resort when nothing else has worked. Judges, county attorneys, public defenders, social workers, law enforcement, medical personnel, friends, and relatives may be involved in the process. All 87 Minnesota counties are subject to the Civil Commitment Act, which has resulted in varying interpretations. And a statewide online training program will provide a consistent interpretation and understanding to those who work within the civil commitment process and also to the general public. And with us today is Sue Abderholden, Executive Director for the National Alliance on Mental Illness, NAMI, and she will provide testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Ms. Abderholden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Sue Abderholden, NAMI, Minnesota. I'll be brief. I just want to say that it is a balancing act when it comes to the Commitment Act. You're looking at people's rights and also society's obligation to care for those who aren't able to agree to treatment. So it's really critical that we have education on the law that's easily accessible and free. And again, with 87 different counties and the countless individuals who are involved in the commitment process, we want to make sure that they understand it. When I came to NAMI 12 years ago, the number one phone call into our small office was about the Commitment Act. We actually developed a little booklet just to help families and actually even attorneys sometimes look at this to help them through it. In some of the smaller counties, you're only dealing with a couple of commitments a year. The recent ANOCA report that was sent to the legislature actually referenced a survey that was completed by the Mayo Blue Earth County Collaborative, which found widely varying understandings of the commitment process among county and hospital staff. And then the early intervention law is also rarely used. So I think this is an opportunity to pull everyone together to say, what are the most frequently asked questions? Where do people really, what don't they understand about the law? Provide clarity and easily accessible training for everyone. And I would urge you to support this.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Are there any questions at this time on this request for an appropriation for an online training program on civil commitment to get some consistency through the state and to be in, to get people informed. Senator Rosen.
Just briefly, I would assume there are there's a template from the department to have an online training program. I would assume they don't have to create this out of something new. There's, I would assume.
Ms. Abderholden?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, they do webinars and things like that now, so I don't think that would be too hard. I think part of it is just the time. The Mental Health Division, frankly, doesn't have a lot of staff, and they're going to need to bring people together to put this forward. Right now, the only person that does really any training on the commitment law is one person in the Ombudsman's office, which isn't enough to travel around to 87 different counties.
But the Ombudsman would be integrated into developing the content of this webinar. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, Senator Rosen?
Madam Chair, I'd like to move that Senate File 1731 be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Finance, please.
Is there any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Thank you, Senator Clausen. Thank you, Ms. Abderholden.
Thank you to Senator Sharon and committee.
Is Senator Senjum available?
came running in the room.
Senator Pappas is presenting bills in other committees, so we will be moving around a little bit today. I'm sorry if you're here on some of the bills that we're skipping. We will come back to them. On Senate File 1877, this is the eyeglass prescription expiration date exception, but I think you have your own name for this bill. Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is the so-called eyeglass prescription expiration date exemption, if I didn't say that. Otherwise known in some degree of comedy to the Freedom to See Act. And it's it relates to an amendment that we had off the floor of the Senate last year, which led to this hearing today, and it involves obtaining a new set of glasses, in particular in my instances, and maybe just as well to just in a minute or so explain my situation. Saturday morning, break my frames, go to Lens Crafters, say I want those frames, which turned out to be these, and here's my lenses, just grind my lenses and put them in the frame, and I'll pay for them, and I'll be on my way. And I'm confounded by the statement that we can't do that. It's against the law because your prescription is 4 years old. In other words, your refraction. So, okay, let's get a refraction one. Well, we can't today because we're all booked up. And so I go to two other eyeglass retailers in Rochester, and they're all booked up as well. I do find a third one eventually and do get my refraction, take it back to Lens Crafters, and they carve my glasses. But I was a little dumbfounded by the idea that that one cannot, with their own money and with a pair of glasses that about 2 months previous to that, I passed the state driver's license exam just fine, that I couldn't simply with my own money buy a pair of glasses and have those frames, which to me, frankly, were perfectly adequate and suitable for my life. And being in somewhat of an emergency mode because we're back at the state capitol on Monday, and frankly, I need glasses. So this attempts to maybe rectify that, and it simply says in emergency situations or loss of glasses, an optician, optometrist, physician, or eyeglass retailer may make a new pair of prescription glasses using a prescription from the old glasses or the last prescription available. And it's a may. I emphasize may. Doesn't have to do it. And then notwithstanding subdivision 2, which is all about the fact that a prescription for eyeglasses is a 2-year prescription in law, that a person may elect to use the eyeglass prescription needed for the expired prescription if the person has been advised, et cetera, about risks, et cetera. So that's the bill, and just urge some brief discussion and consideration.
Thank you, Senator Senjum. Are there any questions for Senator Senjum at this time? Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there any particular reason, Senator Senjum, that you didn't include contact lenses?
Madam Chair. And
Senator Senjum.
No, there is no particular reason. I just didn't. And I do think people obviously lose contacts probably more frequently than they break frames. But it's just no particular reason.
Did you want to make an amendment in relationship to that? Think about that. Senator Senjum, you know, one of the parts of your testimony, and I have had just a brief conversation with you last night about this, that when you go in and make a request to have your glasses renewed, that it's reported to you that they can't do a, because your prescription is lapsed, that it's against the law for them to do this without another examination. And so I'm going to ask our legal counsel to speak to that. I don't think that, and then come back to the language of your bill again.
Madam Chair and members.
Ms. Kavanaugh.
In looking at the statute, actually the law that that says that the prescription is only 2 years old only applies to contact lenses. It does not apply to eyewear glasses. The two-year prescription is a practice standard that optometrists writes on the prescription and says that it's valid, usually for the 2 years from the date of the exam and 2 years later. So, you know, you do cover in your law or the practice to the contrary. So it still works, but just to clarify that the two-year requirement in law is only for contact lenses and does not apply to the eyeglasses.
Madam Chair, that's a fine point that I missed then.
Let me just follow up. Would you say, you went on to say something further besides it's not in the law, but something about practice is in the law, is in that language?
Madam Chair, the 2 years, optometrists write on their prescription there is a little expiration date, and they usually, because it's the common practice, optometry practice, to have those prescriptions expire 2 years from the date of the exam. That's something that the occupation has decided to follow, not because it's a requirement in law. And your bill, 1877, does add that says, or notwithstanding any law or practice to the contrary. So,
and so the language, Senator Senjum, where it says a practice to the contrary, if it's their practice to do that, they could continue to refuse to fill a prescription under this law. So,
yeah. Madam Chair, and the bill is all permissive. It's may throughout. There's no shells in here that I see.
Any further questions? You do not want to make any changes in relationship to what you're hearing about the law. For example, you could say must, or you could eliminate notwithstanding any law or practice the contrary. You could start with in an emergency situation. In an emergency situation, you must afford this right to the person who's trying to purchase glasses.
Madam Chair,
since it's not against the law.
Are you on line 111?
Pardon?
Are you on line 111 as your?
I'm on 1.8. I'm on 1.7. You could. Right. I'm just offering you this, since it's not written in statute that it's against the law to do this. It's by practice. They're checking. Right. A prescription. You could eliminate notwithstanding any law or practice to the contrary and start with in and eliminate may to must. That changes it to say, in an emergency situation or in cases of lost glasses, an optician, optometrist, physician, or eyeglass retailer must make a new pair of prescription eyeglasses using the prescription from the old lenses or the last prescription available. It gives the purchaser the right to purchase it, because there's nothing in the law that says you have to have a prescription in order to purchase a new pair of glasses.
And Madam Chair, that would accomplish that if there were a member that was willing to make that amendment orally, but certainly fine with me. It gets to the point I'm trying to make.
I'm willing to make that as an oral amendment. So I'll repeat it on line 1.7. Eliminate everything from the beginning, A, through the period, and begin with in. On lines 1.8, eliminate the word may and replace it with the word must. Is there any discussion on that amendment? Seeing none, Senator Marty, excuse me.
Madam Chair, the line 1.8, you're changing that may to must?
On line 1.8, the last word may changes to must.
Madam Chair, I'm glad we're taking out the notwithstanding any law that when there isn't one, apparently. But are we saying that who knows what an emergency situation is? We are ordering an optician to make a new pair of glasses for somebody? I mean, I don't have a problem with taking out the first clause, but changing may to must strikes me as we're going to tell these medical providers, businesses, whatever it is, that they must make somebody a new pair of glasses?
And Madam Chair,
Senator Sengen.
I think Senator Marty makes a good point. What I was confronted with was just a solid no, we can't do that, it's against the law. And at least that would give the optometrist an opportunity to make his or her decision about whether or not they want to serve me as a customer.
Senator Lurie.
Personally, I mean, I understand that there's not a law, but there is a practice, and with an expiration date of a prescription, I mean, I think in that general practice setting, you know, it might give some comfort to the optometrist who's thinking they might like to do this if they don't have this that says notwithstanding any practice to the contrary, I'm about to fill a prescription that when I look at it, it says it's expired, and that's outside of my practice.
Sure.
You know, I mean, that's outside of my, so I mean, I actually think the notwithstanding clause, even though it doesn't apply to a law, does apply to a practice that if we take it out might actually make optometrists less willing to actually do this. Unless we made them do it with the must, and then we have a host of other situations.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I don't know whose amendment it was that you were trying to work with them on, but I'm wondering if we could change it to then, based on what Senator Lurie is saying, notwithstanding any practice to the contrary, an optometrist, physician, whatever, may. So don't change the may to must, and keep in the, just take out notwithstanding any law, but just notwithstanding any practice.
Senator Sengen? You accept that amendment to the amendment?
Yes. We can work with it. I always get nervous when we're trying to make a bill on the fly, but, you know, and we shouldn't probably go much longer.
No, we aren't going to. this was a promise we made on the floor of the Senate.
Right.
So. Okay, so can I just read the corrected language? So the amendment is, notwithstanding any practice to the contrary in an emergency situation or in the case of lost glasses, an optician, optometrist, physician, or eyeglass retailer may. That is the amendment. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. Passes. And now, would somebody be willing to move Senate File 1877? Oh, there's someone else who wishes to testify. Please.
Is that on our Madam Chair, Dr. Jonathan Shorn, immediate past president of the Minnesota State Optometric Association, and very good discussions that you're having. I must let you know that we are significantly opposed to this language. As medical professionals, it is our charge to try to make sure that any prescription that is filled is done so with the understanding that the patient has had a full examination to be able to afford myself the safety or the lack of liability if a person should have a problem. When a person fills a prescription that may be expired, that does not allow the professional professional who wrote that original prescription to once again reaffirm that the person has good peripheral vision, that they're going to be able to operate a motor vehicle correctly. Doesn't talk anything about allow us to be able to reevaluate whether the two eyes are working together as a team or whether the person has depth perception still intact. And in reality, doesn't really say whether the vision is still adequate. And so I would say that the vast majority of my colleagues throughout the state would, in an emergency situation, be able to get the patient in within a matter of hours to be able to get that new prescription and do that evaluation. And that's, again, from a medical standpoint, what our main goal is to protect not only the patient but the public as well. The other piece that I'm very concerned with is, or that we are very concerned with as an association, is that there's no definition of what an emergency is. And we believe that patients could very easily try to circumvent the system and use that to their advantage. And so, therefore, I would urge you to please vote no to this bill as it stands. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Dr. Shorn. Sorry, I should have noticed that you had requested. I'm sorry. Are there any questions for Dr. Shorn? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned liability, Dr. Shorn, and as I was sitting here thinking about, I have on my driver's license the fact I have to wear glasses, and I thought, where's the liability? So could you expound on that a little bit more, go deeper in the weeds on what kind of liability are you talking here? Criminal, civil? I mean, what is it that this could potentially do for you?
Well, the question there would be, Madam Chair, Senator, the question would be is if a person fills a prescription that I have verified and said that, you know, that this is legal, that this corrects a person's vision to the degree where they can then be safe to drive their motor vehicle, and a person has an accident, then, again, it comes back, you know, to I'm responsible ultimately for that patient. I forgot to mention earlier, I want to just expound on this, but, you know, as we sometimes think of glasses as sort of as this external thing that doesn't really need a prescription, but glasses and vision is just as critical as an oral prescription for, say, a high blood pressure medication. You know, your regular doctor wouldn't renew your blood pressure medication without first coming in for an evaluation. And again, we have to start thinking of glasses and contact lenses in that same fashion, that these can have some impact on our well-being, and we need to treat them as such. And that's why for many years we've had law that prescription is required for the glasses as well as contact lenses. And you made the good point that there is no expiration date per se, but that's left up to our medical judgment. And we believe that we should still be allowed to make that medical judgment. I'm glad you did not change the word to must. Thank you.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd just like to remind the body that you can have glasses for 10 years. There's no mandate that you get them renewed. And I actually think it's far riskier for somebody with a 4-year-old prescription to break their lenses and then attempt to drive without corrected vision. I have highly corrected vision, and I have a pair of 3-year-old glasses that stay in my overnight bag in case something happens. But if I need to wear a 3-year-old prescription because I scratch cornea, that is what I do. And so I think this is common sense. I respect a great deal your professional opinion, but at some point we need to say, you know what, let's just get people with glasses so they're not driving with completely uncorrected vision. Would support the bill as amended.
Any further discussion? Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I was going to make a point similar to what Senator Benson had, and that is that folks who can afford to get 2 eyeglasses at a time have a backup pair. I don't know how old these are, but they're, if they broke tomorrow, I think I still have my last pair, which are long expired, but there are a lot of people who don't have that sort of thing, and I think the reality is I don't want medical folks to be doing stuff against their wishes, but I think it is helpful that advising the person that you want them to have a new exam as well is good, but I think the reality is I'd rather have somebody driving within or doing whatever, functioning with an expired pair of prescription glasses rather than not at all. And I think that this bill is fairly modest here. I don't like notwithstanding laws, but in this case, it's gone. I know we took that out, so I think it's okay now.
Okay, thank you. Any further discussion? Senator Senjum, you have the last word.
In the case mentioned, I would have been happy to sign. I mean, I was desperate for glasses. I was going to use a mid-90s pair of glasses to come to the Senate next week. And so I would be happy to sign a, you know, hold harmless or whatever from the standpoint of legal liability. And I think, you know, this probably happens rarely, but, you know, what if I was 90 years old in a long-term care facility and you know, generally not terribly mobile, and, you know, I have to go downtown and get et cetera, et cetera. I mean, I think there are circumstances here that this particular bill would play to that would alleviate some, you know, some just unnecessary activity.
Any further discussion? The motion, has there been a motion made on this bill?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Nelson moves Senate file 1877 be passed and laid over to be included in our omnibus bill. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. Bill passes. Thank you, Senator. We just asked Senator Tory's ready to come down. So if you will please proceed, and then we'll follow with Senator Pappas's bills. We'll start with Senate File 2140, Dementia Training Act, Alzheimer's Disease Training Requirement for Long-Term Care Facilities. Senator Tory's ready, you were not here at the beginning. I think maybe your testifiers were. But we have agreed. There's somebody that's got a phone or something by the mic. We've agreed to take on a lot of extra bills. So we're asking the authors and their presenters to be very succinct, focusing specifically on the policy questions in the bill, and to not the testifiers to get very directly to the point of the bill and not to repeat each other. So with that, please move forward. Thank you.
So much, Madam Chair. Absolutely. We're prepared to just go over the bill. As you know, we have some caring individuals who have been working on this issue for a very long time. We had differences of opinion as to how far do we need to go with training, because some of us feel very strongly that everybody, including our own families, need to be trained on how to deal with a very vulnerable population, and it's a population that is growing. And obviously in the practical world, we needed to figure out how do we do this in a meaningful way so that we provide the training that is necessary, but we do it in a way that really creates these safety measures that we need in the different facilities that provide care. So we're going to go very quickly through the bill to explain the pieces and answer questions from committee members.
Thank you, Senator. Who will be... whoever wants to begin, please introduce yourself. Or are you going to go through the bill, Senator? Or?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before we do that, we need to move the A1 amendment, if you could help me.
Thank you. There's an A1 amendment. Senator Wicklund offers the A1 amendment for Senator Tory's Ray. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay.
Thank you,
Senator Wicklund.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Carrie Thurlow. I'm the Senior Vice President of Advocacy for Aging Services of Minnesota, and I'm here today on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. Before I make any comments with regard to the bill, I'll just kind of do a quick walkthrough of what the bill is as amended, what it contains. And I'm happy to say at the outset that this is a compromise that was negotiated and agreed to by a vast array of stakeholders, and really happy that we are here today. So just very quickly, Section 1 of the bill strengthens dementia training requirements for providers of housing with services. There's two portions to this section. The first section relates to those housing with services providers that really specialize in memory care. Either they have a specialized unit, or they promote or advertise or otherwise hold themselves out as having kind of a specialty in memory care. In those settings, Section 1 sets forth specific hourly training requirements on topics related to dementia. For supervisors of direct care providers, that would mean 8 hours of training on topics specified related to dementia care within their first 120 hours of employment, and then 2 hours of continuing education every 12 months after that. for direct care employees that are not supervisory, the requirement is 8 hours of training on topics related to dementia within the first 160 hours of training or of employment date, and then 2 hours of continuing education on these topics for every 12 months of employment after that. And for staff who do not provide direct care, such as maintenance or housekeeping or food service staff, the requirement is 4 hours of initial training within the first 160 hours of employment, and then 2 hours of training thereafter. This is a strengthening of the current law, which does require training in these settings, but did not require specified hours. And so we view this as very much a strengthening. The second part of Section 1 then does relate to other assisted living settings that may not hold themselves out to have a specialty but serve, do provide assisted living settings, providing services for seniors. And there the training requirement is 4 hours of training on dementia training topics related to dementia. For supervisors, it would be within the first 120 hours of employment start date. And for all other employees, it's 4 hours within 160 hours of the employment start date. And so, again, this would be a new training requirement for those assisted living providers, but we think is a significant step in the right direction. Section 2 relates to manager trainings, and this does not actually relate directly to dementia training, although there is a dementia training requirement. This has to do with the individuals that are designated that are primarily responsible for the oversight and management of housing with services establishments. Currently, there are no continuing education requirements for those folks that are typically called housing managers. And Section 2 would require would put in place a new requirement of 30 hours of continuing education every 2 years that they are employed in those positions. There are specific hours that must be included in that 30 hours for dementia training. For those establishments that specialize, it would be 8 hours, and for those establishments that don't have that specialty, it would be 4 hours. I would note that for that continuing education requirement, training that would be used to maintain other professional licensures, such as administrator of a long-term care setting or a nursing license, could be counted towards that those 30 hours. Section 3 establishes disaster or emergency planning procedures for housing with services settings. Currently, we don't have any disaster or emergency planning requirements, and so this sets in place some basic requirements that every housing with services setting have emergency planning procedures and have a plan in place. I would note that most of our members do this already, but we think that it is good practice to have those standards in place as we see expansion of this sector in Minnesota. And then last but not least, Section 4 is an evaluation and reporting section that says that, you know, this is a first step in strengthening our dementia training requirements. But there were a lot of questions raised amongst the stakeholders. As Senator Torres-Ray mentioned, this was not easy to get here, that there's a vast variety of opinions out there about additional steps that can be taken. And so we are committed to continuing the conversation, to working with all the stakeholders and the Department of Health to address some specific questions, including other settings that should be included in dementia training requirements, other provider types, other licensed or unlicensed personnel, and then also looking at what the appropriate mechanism is for delivering those education requirements and the costs involved. I know I went through that extremely quickly. I do also want to thank Senator Torres-Ray and many of the members on the committee for their work and discussion on these issues, and I'd be happy to take any questions in this regard.
Thank you, Ms. Thurlow. I thought you did a great job of articulating the essence of the bill, and I think in a very understandable way, and that's what I appreciate. So thank you for that. Ms. Mueller? Oh, excuse
me. Senator
Benson.
First of all, Madam Chair, and I would commend Senator Torres-Ray for bringing everybody together. I love that it's non-prescriptive, so it can be done to suit the facilities, as is sort of their style for approach to dealing with Alzheimer's and dementia. May I propose a very tiny
amendment. On page 2, line 33, where it says, after establishment, comma, must obtain at least 30 hours of continuing education for every 2 years of employment. It seems to me, as written, someone could take 60 hours and then say, okay, I'm good for 4 years. But, Madam Chair, I believe I've consulted with counsel adequately. If we delete the word for before every, so that the sentence would read, or the phrase would read, must obtain at least 30 hours of continuing education every 2 years, I think that would just tighten it up. It's not a big deal, but I think a little grammatical adjustment if the author would be amenable.
Senator Torres Reid.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that is, even grammatically, it reads better with your amendments and defenses. Thank you.
Then, Madam Chair, I would move that on line 2.33, we delete the word for.
Any further discussion on the amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Amendment passes. Our next testifier, please. Susan Smelding, please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Madam Chair, thank you and members of the committee. My name is Susan Spalding, and I am the CEO of the Alzheimer's Association Minnesota North Dakota chapter. I'm excited to represent the association here in strong support of House File 2437. This bill represents a collaborative work with Care Providers Minnesota, Aging Services of Minnesota, and many other stakeholders, and I'm so pleased that we were all able to come together and work on this because we all have a common goal in mind. The association sought partners to advance this issue due to a significant increase in callers to our 24/7 helpline. Family members were calling the association searching for solutions to their issues with staff competency in assisted living environments and other types of facilities. And you may be surprised to learn that 64% of residents in assisted living facilities have some form of Alzheimer's or other dementia. Many of the questions families raised centered on staff communication with their loved one and in areas such as providing respect and dignity for the resident as they progressed through the stages of the disease. The legislation requires at least 8 hours of initial training and 4 hours of initial training for staff such as maintenance, housekeeping, and food services, which we've already said. 8 hours is a start and a good strengthening, and we are pleased that this is a step forward. We look forward to continuing our collaborative partnership as we continue to fight this devastating disease. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And members, there is a fact sheet on Alzheimer's from the association in among your materials to describe more of the details of about what's happening to us with this disease and to families. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Thurlow or Senator Torres Reid, can you tell me where this training is coming from and who provides the training?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, the training, we had a lot of discussion about where the training should come from. And as was indicated, it's actually left very flexible. So there are a variety of programs that another collaboration, a large collaboration called Act on Alzheimer's, has identified a number of programs that meet this. Either they're webinars, they can be done in person, there's a variety. But we also have providers that have excellent in-service programs as well. And the goal is, by making it flexible, is to accommodate not only the wide variety of assisted living and housing with services settings we have, but we also know that we have providers throughout the state, some of which are very remote and very small and can't spare their staff to come to in-person training. And so by keeping it flexible, we think that there's going to be something for everyone out there and also kind of help control the cost to the provider at the outset. So there's, for example, there's training that Aging Services and the Alzheimer's Association have developed jointly that we provide. There are webinars provided by private companies. I know the Alzheimer's Association also does their own training. So there's a lot of different sources out there and a wide variety. And the training is always being improved and developed throughout the years.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the program is not necessarily accredited. And I would assume, I'm hoping that there will be one template statewide for these programs. So everybody is getting a consistent training program going forward.
Madam Chair,
Ms. Thurlow?
Senator Rosen, the program in this particular bill is not accredited. It does not call for accreditation. There are topics that are specified in current law, and of course the training needs to relate to those topics. And accreditation was something that we talked a lot about in the stakeholder group and, quite frankly, just did not arrive at agreement. But we would anticipate that the form of the education, the delivery, would be something that would be discussed in the next phase, in the study and evaluation phase in the stakeholder group.
Thank you, Madam Chair, if I may.
Yes, Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you. Very definitely, Senator Rosen. This is really a very preliminary step, and very much a result of negotiation and convening people to talk about, because there are very strong feelings about how trained our people, the people need to be to serve a fast-growing population. But we hope that we can come back to talk about it. We'll be delighted to engage in a conversation about how can we do it consistently, what are the organizations, what kind of requirements we need to put in place. We kind of started, in very different places with requirements that were a lot stronger than this, and then kind of moving to something that at least we can begin a good conversation right now.
Okay. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Torres Ray, I want to thank you for working diligently to get this bill before us in a form that all feel that they can implement. Alzheimer's is really the defining disease of our generation, and how we handle it and prepare for it is going to so impact almost every aspect of our society. And so I strongly support this bill. I'd like to just give a plug to the Alzheimer's organization. They've been incredibly helpful as we've gone through this journey in my family. So thank you for taking this preliminary step.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any further questions or discussion? Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I too, applaud all your efforts to get to a compromise. I know that it started from very different places, and that can be very difficult. I want to ask about the Commissioner of Health's duties and any cost associated with that. Is there still a cost associated with this? Is that your understanding?
Thank you, Senator Lurie, Madam Chair.
Senator Torres Ray.
It is my understanding that there is a small fiscal note associated with this, so these will be going to finance.
That's part of my question. Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, in here too, there's an interesting clause, paragraph 5 of the evaluation that they're going to do is evaluating the enforceability of these statutes. Is there a question as to whether we're putting in statutes that are unenforceable? Is that my read of that portion of the evaluation?
Ms. Thurl? Ms. Thurlow.
Madam Chair, Senator Lurie, and perhaps the Department of Health might be better equipped to answer that question. But as I understand it, because these training requirements don't take effect until January 1st, 2016, there is some discussion about whether there needs to be additional clarity about the enforcement. Although the stakeholders did feel it was important to at least put the expectation of the training in place to let providers know, there is a discussion about whether that mechanism needs to be clarified further.
Any other questions? Senator Torres Ray, any final comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, for your support. As you know, we have a significant coalition that has been working very hard to get us here, and the Alzheimer's Association. I've been working with them for a number of years now, so I'm very pleased that we were able to come together and move this forward. And again, as Senator Rosen stated, this is really a beginning of a conversation, and hopefully we will continue to talk about how we can do a better job of serving this population and our responsibility, not only to put this in legislation, but also to provide the resources so that we take care of this population. So thank you to the coalition, to the different members who have been working on this.
Thank you. Is there someone who would make the motion? Or Senator Benson?
Madam Chair, I move that Senate File 2140 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance.
Is it amended? Is that correct? Okay. So Senator Benson moves that Senate File 2140 as amended be recommended to pass and recommended to pass and be referred to Finance. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? Motion passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
And now we are moving to Senator Pappas' bill. Senate File 1696.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And in the interest of time with these three bills, we're going to try to be as brief as possible and limit our testifiers. Madam Chair and members of the committee, Senate File 1696 simply is a technical change to the definition of who is a certified doula, and we would like to add the organization Common Sense Childbirth, Inc. And that language needs to be replaced on line 1.11. The name, Birthplace Common Childbirth, Inc. is not the proper name.
I'm sorry, Senator Pappas, are you looking at the A1 author's amendment, or are you looking at the original?
I don't have an author's amendment, so maybe the A1 author's amendment takes care of it.
I'm sorry, we have one here, so I'm just trying to...
Somebody is just very efficient.
That's it?
Okay, so...
Is this the change that you...
This is the change
are asking for. Okay, so Senator Pappas has an author's amendment, the A1 amendment. Are there any questions? Senator Nino?
Thank you. I'd certainly vote for it. It's an author's amendment. I just was curious. I'm no grand grammarian, but we're adding the in front of organizations that grammatically seems odd to me. Is that just a matter of consistency, or do you know why? So we're calling it the Birthworks and...
Ms. Kavanaugh, is that a council thing?
I don't know.
Senator Pappas.
Some mysterious person put the in there. We don't know who. Maybe the reviser did. I don't
reviser
know.
Reviser did.
Yeah. But there's absolutely no reason to have it. So.
Okay, should we take them out?
While we're debating the, I'll just tell you that Common Sense Childbirth is a 501c3 nonprofit that was formed in 1998 to enhance women's experience of childbirth and improve perinatal outcomes using a midwifery model of care. They've been very successful in reducing disparities in birth outcomes through parent access to trained peer supporters and mentors and long-term relationships through pregnancy and the postpartum period. So we know that our doula programs are very successful in reducing C-sections and better patient outcomes and more patient and parent satisfaction levels. And it's just a very lovely way to give birth. I got to be the doula for my daughter's baby last birth. I'm not a trained doula, but I got to play that role. In fact, I even got to play the role of midwife since I caught the baby. So I'm just a longtime advocate of midwifery and doulas and babies. You all know I have 18 grandchildren, and so I'm just trying to get you to support my bill by telling you the story. We're still debating.
Yeah, Madam Chair and members, you know,
it's
this is going to be rolled into our omnibus bill, so let me, I think some of the thes might be appropriate, some of them might not be, so let me just like, I'll relook at, you know, look at it again and we'll fix it in the omnibus bill.
Thank you.
So let's go back to the, let's adopt the amendment. Can I move it or do I need somebody else to move it? Would someone please move the author's amendment? Senator Rosen moves to amend Senate File Number 1696 with the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? Okay. Please proceed.
Madam Chair, if someone would like to move to incorporate it into your omnibus bill or lay it over for your omnibus bill, whatever you do.
Do you want your testifier to add some words? Or
if anyone had any questions for, this is Susan Lane, with the Better Birth Minnesota Coalition. She's just here if there are any
Members, do you have any questions? Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a brief question. I know that there's, I have a friend who's a trained doula, and my question is, I want to know, is she going to be covered by this? In other words, are there any organizations that are training doulas right now that are not listed here who would not be considered a certified doula?
These organizations... I am Susan Lane from the Better Birth
Thank
Coalition.
You.
Senator, yes, there are other organizations that train doulas. I think we have covered all of the ones that I'm aware of in the state of Minnesota. And these are certainly all the major ones that have done the most training.
Thank you.
My guess, if she's in Minnesota, she's been trained by DONA, actually.
Thank you very much.
Senator Rosen, did you have a question?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. And Ms. Lane, is this a growing... Are we going to be coming back next year adding more doulas onto to the statutes?
Ms.
Madam
Lane?
Chair and Senator Rosen, that's a really good question. And one of the things that is happening is that there is a doula registry, which is what this is about. And we have spoken with the health department, in particular Ann Kukowski, who is in charge of the registry. And we are going to go through all of these organizations and standardize the credentialing and the requirements. And I suspect there will be one more time we're here with one more bill that really sets that specifically. It is in progress right now. So we've got that underway. So there may be some here that are eliminated, but all of the ones that are included will be included.
Any further questions? Senator Roseman?
Madam Chair, I move that Senate file 1696.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did Senator Hoffman, did you have a question?
No, ma'am. Madam Chair, I'm fine. Senator Rosen's motion.
Thank you.
Senate file 1696 be recommended pass and moved
as
into
amended.
The omnibus bill. Is that correct?
Senator Rosen moves that Senate file 1731 as amended. Oh, I'm sorry. 1696 as amended.
As amended, that's right.
Be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus policy bill. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed?
Thank you very
passes.
Much.
Thank you. Now we have Senator Pappas with Senate File 2394. And that is patient notice with mammogram results requirement. I'm sorry.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. This bill is about giving women information about their own health and about raising their awareness. Current federal law already requires that when women have a mammogram performed, they receive a written report of the results. This bill simply adds language to that report that is already generated, letting women know if they have dense breast based on a classification system established by the American College of Radiology. Why is this important to know? Having dense breast tissue may increase your risk of getting breast cancer. Dense breast tissue also makes it harder for doctors to see cancer on mammograms. On mammograms, dense breast tissue looks white, and breast masses or tumors also look white. So you could have a false negative, you could have a false positive. Since 2009, 14 states have passed breast density notification language, with legislation currently introduced in 12 states. This bill isn't telling doctors how to practice medicine. This is simply giving women information about their own health. Women can then decide if they want to have a further conversation with their physician, and they will be able to go into this conversation educated about their own body. A woman and her physician can determine together whether any additional screening is needed. Women in 14 other states have this information. I believe that women in Minnesota need it as well. The Minnesota Radiology Society supports this legislation. If anyone has any questions, Dr. Joseph Tashian is here and available to answer questions. And Sarah Lawrence is here to share her story with you.
Sarah.
For the record, my name is Sarah Leverance. Some of you may know me as the lobbyist for AFSCME Council 65. But I'm here today on my own behalf to tell you about dense breasts and cancer. On September 9th, 2011, I was diagnosed with advanced stage 3 breast cancer. Today, 9 surgeries, 4.5 months of chemo, 6.5 weeks of radiation, a year's worth of Herceptin infusions every 3 weeks, and a 5-year drug regimen I'm on now with a lot of difficult side effects. I have, in spite of all of this, only a 42% chance to live till September 2011. People ask me why. Didn't you have a mammogram? I had a mammogram every year between age 30 and when I was diagnosed at age 54 on the advice of my doctor. But my problem is I have dense breasts, and mammograms often do not find tumors in dense breasts. But never in any of the 25 mammograms reports I received was I told that I had dense breasts that could hide tumors. I first found a lump in my left breast when I was undergoing physical therapy for that area. I was sent to the breast center. They did biopsies and ultrasounds and determined that the tumor was 0.6 centimeters in diameter. When I had the lumpectomy, the tumor was found to be the size of a lemon. They just hadn't seen much of it. Cancer is all about statistics and how you get treated. And because my lemon-sized tumor was actually 3 tumors, I was advised to have a mammogram or a mastectomy, and I did. They found 2 more tumors in that breast that they had never seen. At one point, I asked one of my oncologists, was that tumor there 8 months before I was diagnosed when I had a mammogram? He didn't even pause saying yes. I do not know what, if anything, I would have done differently if I'd known that I had dense breasts. I can tell you that 1.5 years ago, I made what was the most difficult decision of my life, to have the other breast removed. They found a new and different cancer there, even though I'd had an MRI beforehand. I am hopeful that someday there will be scans that can tell women that who have dense breasts whether they have cancer or not. I am guessing that will cost money. But my health insurance company has spent $500,000 treating me for my cancer. I have to believe that a scan would cost a lot less, and that I wouldn't be staring a 42% chance of survival in the face. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing. Members, do you have any questions for Senator Pappas or the testifiers?
Madam Chair and members,
Senator Pappas.
Since we're laying this bill over, I did want to let you know that there is just one unresolved issue, and that there is very specific language in the bill about what the notice should say, and we are definitely flexible on that language. Some of the healthcare entities have requested that, you know, it be phrased more simply, or that they be allowed to phrase it as they feel is appropriate for their patients, and so we're very open to that idea, and we'll be getting back to you about that.
Thank you. Any other questions or discussion based on that information? Well, thank you for bringing this to us. And would someone care to move? Senator Hoffman moves that Senate files 2394 be passed and laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus policy bill. Any other discussion? All those in favor? You're looking at me. Okay. I just want to make sure that was correct. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion passes.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Senator Pappas, we have Senate File 1857, safe harbor for sexually exploited youth, director duties, expansion, service grants, and safe housing appropriations. Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Most of this bill is directed to the Finance Committee, but we did have one policy change on how the proposal requests are provided, and we have Jeff Bowers here with me if anyone is interested in just having an update on what's happening with the safe harbor legislation that was passed last year.
Members, any interest in hearing an update on where things have gone? Yeah, I think we'd be interested in a brief, very short update. Thank you. And please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Jeff Bauer. I'm the Director of Public Policy at the Family Partnership. Thanks for the opportunity to be here, and a quick thank you to Ms. White and Mr. Albrecht for helping us get our language in order on this bill. We appreciate it, too. Very quickly, we came out of last session with $2.8 million to get a toehold on Minnesota's safe harbor system, $1 million for shelter and housing, which has been granted out, another $1 million for a statewide safe harbor director position, who is now in place, six regional positions, and that RFP process is still ongoing, and then the final $800,000 for training for law enforcement. So we're working as hard and as diligently as we can to be ready for the August implementation date when the safe harbor law goes into effect. The bill this year we'll talk a lot more about in Finance Committee, but basically one of the areas we weren't able to fund last year was this comprehensive services fund, and this is the whole range of services that child sex trafficking victims need, from civil legal services to mental and chemical health, family reunification, those kinds of things, we weren't able to fund. And so the one sentence of policy language that you see in this bill, all that does is it expands the safe harbor director's duties to be able to manage such a fund if we are able to obtain those funds in this session. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, do you have any questions? Senator Hoffman.
Madam Chair, thank you. Senator Pappas, you know, I was, Christine and I have been involved with some homeless issues in our area, and there are 1,700 homeless youth between the Osseo and the Anoka-Hennepin School District. And what was really more alarming is how many are unaccompanied, which end up being the ones that we hear about on the exploitation. Thank you for bringing this forward, and I think if we had more money, let's put more money to it. But I appreciate the work you're doing, and I move this. Let's move this on to the omnibus.
Thank you,
Madam Chair. And we know that there's a lot of crossover between trafficking children that are trafficked, and homeless youth. Homeless youth might start out bartering sex for food or a place to live, and then they end up being captured by the pimps and the traffickers. So it definitely is a crossover. We're making great strides. In fact, I should just let you know that we're hosting this national conference next summer for National Conference of State Legislators, and they're going to feature trafficking because we're a model. We hope to have Cindy McCain and Amy Klobuchar give the plenary because they've been involved on a national level, and have local sessions with some of our kind of local people who have been very involved in this, both the advocates and the law enforcement officers and the prosecutors. And then in the exhibit hall, we're going to have an activity where legislators and staff and lobbyists from all over the country can sign letters to Backpage.com asking them to no longer facilitate trafficking.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Peppers. So, were there any other questions? Oh, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Bauer, what exactly is grants for comprehensive services, including trauma-informed? Is the comprehensive services psychiatric? And can you explain what that is for $5 million?
Mr. Bauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Rosen, for the question. Comprehensive services, the two words that we always use are trauma-informed. And what this means is that whoever's administering these, whether it's chemical dependency treatment or mental health or educational services, all those kinds of things, has been trained particularly in the trauma that child sex trafficking victims suffer. And I think we talked about this a little in here last year, too. When they do studies about these kids, they show the same amounts of post-traumatic stress as torture victims do. And so you really need people who have been trained to understand that kind of trauma and to work with that kind of trauma. And a lot of the areas who are now dealing with these cases, especially in greater Minnesota, as the areas are more spread out, the resources are more spread out, and places don't necessarily have ready access to those types of specialized services. And so we really want to create this grant fund to make sure any child who's trafficked can have access to those types of services.
Thank you.
Thank you. And if I could just add really quickly to it, you know, Senator Pappas alluded to it, but we're really lucky to have Senator Pappas be the champion on this, not just in Minnesota, but in this nation and across the world. She's known to be a leader on this, and she's really put Minnesota on the map. So we can match your statewide commitment with hopefully some federal dollars and other resources. So I wanted to thank you publicly and embarrass you in front of the committee.
I just rolled my eyes.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Senator Hoffman moves that Senate File 1857 be recommended, be passed, and referred to Finance. Any other discussion? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Rosen. We have Senate File 2133, Critical Access Dental Provider Requirements Modification.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Exactly. Senate File 2133 is dealing with a critical access dental issue in the state. And I kind of refer to it as the remodeling job, because it's like you want to just fix the sink in the bathroom that's leaking, and all of a sudden you're just doing a whole total redo of this thing, because you know the whole bathroom needs to be redone. And that's what we're eventually going to get to at some point. But right now, this bill basically is going back to a problem that we tried to fix last year, and actually it's caused more problems. I do have the A3 amendment, Madam Chair.
I'd like to move. Can we have that distributed, please?
Madam Chair, if I can just explain a little bit about it before I go into the amendment. Basically, we're going back to the legislation that we had in 2013. What we have right now in the state is critical access dental is obviously not fulfilling all the needs that we have out there, but I did have a provider in my district that called, and he was extremely upset. He was up to about 50% MA for his patients. He was covering about 50% of his patients for MA. And because of this legislation that we passed that is on 2.6, he could not restrict any services to any other person that came into the office. So he found that his services were going up to 70-75%. Now, as a private provider, you can't make any money. And he's old, and it's pushing him to the point where he is about ready to quit because he can't say no because of this one single line. Now, in greater Minnesota, there's not many choices for critical access. And if you are providing critical access, it might be just at a small portion, 20% or something. This gentleman is going up above and beyond what is called for. After talking to him further, too, now we have the situation where there are no oral dental surgeons in the area. And I will say this is a provider in Fairmont, so he can't even recommend them to go to Mankato, which is an hour away, because Mankato, if it's oral surgery, is only taking locals. They aren't taking anybody that is outside their area. So we have this mammoth issue with critical access dental. I think when it was created, it served its purpose. I think it needs to be, as Dominic Spazzetto says, rebooted. So we are looking at having a stakeholder group over the interim. We've had the blessing from the commissioner to take a strong look at this program and say, how are we going to create more access out there, and not only in the metro but in greater Minnesota, of course, and provide the coverage that has to be for these folks. Along with in the A3 amendment is a deadline where we're expiring in the critical access dental program as of July 1st of 2015. And that is, we're giving it a year so we can get this group together. We're trying to retain those funds so they don't get dispersed someplace else. And we will have a talk about maybe single administrator, because when you start talking to these providers with the CAD program, their biggest issues, number one, is low reimbursement. They're doing it out of the, because they're angels. and they want to provide access to these people that need coverage. There's access issues, there's IT issues going forward about my dentist is not digitally wired. He's not ready to do that, and he doesn't have the money. There's also, there's many issues that were brought forward actually in the OLA report on critical access dental, and that I don't know if that was passed out, Madam Chair, or not. But
yes,
it's a very
Senator Rosen. There's a summary, or the
okay, super. That's a very, very good report that came out last year, and I think it's worthy of some attention about what is being recommended there. So we want to take that to heart. Perhaps take a look at this, but for right now, we have found that this one piece of language that they cannot restrict their access is causing a tremendous amount of problems out there.
Senator Rosen, this is an author's amendment. This is your first committee. Do you want to adopt the amendment,
please,
and then we'll
like
move
to move
forward
the A3 amendment, please.
Discussion. Any questions? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The author's A3 amendment is adopted. And do you have a testifier?
I do, Madam Chair. And I just want to say I've just learned, too, that there are no other providers taking new patients in southern Minnesota to date, which is incredible. And at the time the critical access dental program was started, it was 235 providers. Now they're in the mid-50s. And so this is an area that needs some help. I have Dominic Spazzetto from the Dental Association with me, and he can fill in the blanks.
Please proceed with your testimony, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dominic Spazzetto. I'm a contract lobbyist representing the Minnesota Dental Association. This is not an MDA bill. We have a bill introduced that would take this program to a single administrator. That was introduced by Senator Reinert this week. However, we understand that kind of proposal is not prime for this legislative session, so it's something that we introduced to begin the debate on. It's a feature that was mentioned in both the legislative auditor's report and the Department of Human Services study, which you directed them to do last year. So we think there's a lot of consensus around at least looking at this concept of a single administrator, and we would like to push for that. But the issue before you today is the Critical Access Dental Provider Program, which was constructed almost 11 years ago to basically assure a safety net environment for the entire state. At the time when it was fully funded, there were, as Senator Rosen said, 235 participants. But since that time, because of budget cuts and, frankly, opposition to the program from several entities, it's been whittled down to the part where right now it's virtually impossible or very difficult to get into the program if you are a private practice dentist. The rules of the game have been constructed to look at your dental practice by its tax status or its modality. So nonprofit dental clinics would have no problem qualifying for critical access. Obviously, the safety net clinics and federally qualified clinics are all under that rubric. There is a provision for one of the larger health plans to qualify, a specific authorization for them, and there's a specific authorization for the University of Minnesota dental clinics. But as it comes to private practice, in order to participate, you have to get to have 50% of your practice as a state program recipient and also basically take all comers at that position. And that's where we're really running into a problem, especially in a situation where you're the last provider in the county and you cannot continue to provide services at that reimbursement level. We are the 47th in the nation in reimbursing dentists for this particular service. And it is very difficult for a dentist to maintain a practice at 50%. I would say that Senator Rosen's dentist is doing yeoman service by maintaining a practice of that level. We would hope to share the pain, if you would, if we could relook at this program and decide a better way to encourage private practice to participate, because, frankly, in greater Minnesota, they're out there. They need to do the work, and we need to help them to do that. So the drastic cuts in the program were pretty prominent. It went from $25 million down to, I think it's about $12 million or $11 million this time around. And it is a particular issue now as we see the dentists are getting older. And in Senator Rosen's case, that dentist would like to sell his practice to a young dental student to take over that practice. And the difficulty that comes with that is that the dental student will come into that arrangement with a $250,000 to $300,000 debt for going through dental school. They will then have to take a loan to buy into the practice. And when you go to the banker and tell them that the practice is 50% Medicaid, where you get paid 32 cents on the dollar, it's very hard to keep that kind of a practice up. And so we have a real crisis here in greater Minnesota if we don't look at this in a fair and equitable manner. And that's why we believe that we should redo this, reboot, if you will, this program, and look at where we need providers, look at how to encourage providers to participate, and not base it on their tax status or their organizational structure. They all do the same dental care. It's not that unique. It's not that different. I think we should relook at this program, and we encourage you to support Senator Rosen's bill.
Thank you. Excuse me. Are there any other testifiers? Or first I'll ask, are there any questions that members have for the testifier?
And Madam
Senator
Chair,
Rosen?
There is a dispute about whether this should have a fiscal note. I have not seen this yet, the fiscal note. Do you have a fiscal note? There are two arguments to that, whether there should be a fiscal note or not. And so my original amendment was to address some of the critical access issues that are happening in the metro, where they get over 50% of the CAD dollars. But we are not pursuing that yet. I think we're just talking about that will happen in finance as far as how this is going to be funded. And with that, I think we do have a real crisis here. And as we know, dental care is one of the first prevention measures that we can do. So,
okay. I do see someone who wishes to testify. Please come to the table and introduce yourself. Oh, I'm sorry.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Michael Scandrad, and I work with the Minnesota Healthcare Safety Net Coalition. And the Safety Net Coalition represents Minnesota's nonprofit safety net providers, including dental providers who provide care to uninsured, low-income, and disadvantaged populations. And I appreciate the interest of the amendment in trying to preserve the safety net, but I have to strenuously disagree that this is the way to do it. This amendment, by eliminating the critical access dental program, will put many nonprofit dental providers out of business that are currently providing a very substantial amount of care. This program exists to recognize the fact that some providers serve a lot of uninsured patients. They serve primarily Medicaid populations where reimbursement is low, and they have to provide additional services because many of their patients don't speak English, they're from different racial and cultural groups, they have other issues related to poverty. And without this kind of subsidy, these providers will be unable to continue to provide the care. And I would just say that this is a really important issue, and just recently the Department of Human Services issued a report, a major report on dental access. And in that report, it recommended changes to the way in which dental is reimbursed, and it including looking at the critical access, but it recommended that any change be replaced by a program that makes sure that it provides adequate reimbursement for safety net providers and others who are in this situation. So we shouldn't eliminate the program unless we have something to replace it that will ensure that we're not doing serious damage to our safety net system of dental providers that many people today depend on. So it's an important issue. We're happy to work on it, but I know that there are many other safety net dental providers that are going to want to have a chance to talk about the impact this bill would have. We can take as much time as we can here in later committees to do that, but this is a serious problem for the safety net community. Be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Are there any questions? Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Mr. Scandrett, I share your concern about the sunset of the critical access program. I'm wondering your comment on the idea of as long as they're covering at least 50% of their patients are uninsured or MA or MinCare, taking out the requirement that they not restrict the other portion of the bill.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair and Senator Marty, we are supportive of the bill as it was introduced, and without the sunsets to the critical access dental, we don't object to that change.
Thank you. Further questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
In response to Mr. Skandrett's concerns, and I totally understand that, I don't consider this as a elimination. I believe it's, again, a reboot. And as you know, you will not move forward on anything unless you bring everybody to the table. And there is an incentive to get a compromise or some changes to this program because it's not working for everyone as it was designed to do. It is not working. So the opportunity to keep the money in its place and work over the interim with the commitment from the department and the commissioner that this CAD program needs to be redone, I think is well worth it. And I'd also like a response from Mr. Spazzetto.
Mr. Spazzetto, I'll take that first.
Madam Chairman, Mr. Skandrett raises a very valid point, and I think our goal was to do the reboot. We definitely don't want to damage the system that we have now. However, in discussing this with the commissioner, we thought there may be a way to do this where we come up with an alternative program, and that replaces the critical access provider program when that's agreed to, which I hope would be the next legislative session. And by doing that, we would maintain the funding for that program within the budget and the as it goes forward. So we don't want to jeopardize the funding. All we want to do is make sure that we do that. This is the fourth year that we have come and tried to change this program to address one issue or another. And we just think it needs to be redone. And the only way to do that would be to sunset the program, get people to the table, let them know that you, if you want to be in, you have to participate, and we get an agreed-to proposal to bring to you next year.
Mr. Skandrett, did you have a brief comment on?
Yeah, Madam Chair, and just response to that, I think that everyone is committed. I wish that those behind the amendment would have discussed with the safety net community this session their interest in working together, because we are committed to working with it. We think there are ways in which the program could be replaced or improved, and we are committed to doing that next session. The problem with passing this bill in its current form now is that if we fail to reach agreement and pass anything next session, the entire program goes away. So we're stuck with those who would want to make the program go away, able to cause it to go away by refusing to agree or by opposing anything that we have. So the incentives go both ways, and I think that the appropriate thing is to not do anything now, or if you're going to do something, do the entire thing, which I don't think we have this session the time to really figure out the right way to put something in the bill that would replace the program. But again, we'll strenuously object to getting rid of the program now without any other method of shoring up the safety net. And I think that's a pretty serious thing to do just to send a message. And I would strongly encourage everyone to remove that from the bill. And then I think there are some other organizations who would wish to testify as well.
Thank you. First, Senator Hoffman, did you have a question?
Madam Chair, I can wait. I see Mr. Watson. I want to hear more on this. The critical access, the folks that we're talking about, the protected, I'm tongue-tied because I'm seeing this July 1 and I'm confused as to, am I going to be doing some unequivocal harm to individuals out in the community? And if that's the case, then we need to go back and say no to this. But I want to hear what the other testifiers have first, Madam Chair, before I start to process my fragmented thoughts right now.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Watson, please introduce yourself.
Sure. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jonathan Watson. I'm with the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers. We represent the 17 federally qualified health centers in the state that was referenced here earlier. We do provide dental services to roughly 35,000 low-income individuals. 95% of our patients are below 200% of poverty. So the critical access dental provider program isn't a big piece of our business financially. However, a lot of our partners that we rely on, our safety net dentists do rely on it significantly. And I can tell you, every morning at the Community University Healthcare Center in the Phillips neighborhood of Minneapolis, individuals line up for care, hoping that for dental care, hoping that there's a cancellation that day. So that is just the overwhelming demand now at a community health center. In Mankato, Minnesota, the waiting line for dental services, or not the line, but the list, is over 2 months. There are a lot of individuals on that. So what I'm trying to say here is, if we lose our safety net providers who are also providing these services, if their financial sustainability is threatened, that just increases all the more the pressure on the community health center system. You know, we're happy to provide the services, but the timeliness is already at a crisis. I don't see how this really moves the ball forward on that. There are other ways to get people to the table rather than eliminating a program. I think an invitation is a good way to do that. So I'm very interested in working with Senator Rosen and others during the interim. But however, I highly, highly encourage you to eliminate this the 2015 date in there. As the other piece of the bill, I'm supportive of that concern. I get that from a greater Minnesota perspective. So it's the amendment that I do have a problem with.
Any questions for Mr. Watson?
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
My intent is not to cause great angst. My intent is to make sure that we fix this, because this has been going on long enough. This issue has been around a long time. Obviously, we required a study. It's come forward. I think the recommendations from the study are very clear. It's a very good study, and it's very well perceived by the communities. All the communities that study. So with that, I would like to do an oral amendment on 3.8, delete 3.8 and 3.9, or I don't know if that language can be changed to say something about, unless an agreement is made, the services are rendered.
Ms. Can't do that. Our counsel, do you have any comment, Ms. Kavanagh?
Madam Chair and members, you'd have to take it's in two places, because where you
right, two places, yeah.
Where your citing is for the Minnesota Care Program, and 2.29 and 3.30 is for the medical assistance. This does have to go to finance, so.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty,
couldn't we just reconsider the A3 amendment? Wouldn't that accomplish the same thing?
Yeah, absolutely.
If we just go back to the original bill?
Well, not if she wants to add that language that talks about.
Is there something else that's different?
This goes in, you know, if there isn't any sort of agreement with the critical access provider program, that it would go away July 1st, 2015.
Senator Rosen or whomever, I mean, I and I think I hear lots of others expressing concern about the sunset. I share your concern that we fix the program, because I think we've got some problems. I think there's strong support, at least it sounds like it, for the allowing the language online, the language in the original bill. And so I think that the original bill doesn't force the change, but I think the concern is that forcing the change when we don't know what's following means we take it out of the budget, we take it out of everything else. And that's why I'm saying, couldn't we just go back to the original bill? Unless, Senator Rosen, if you're trying to do more than that, maybe so, but if you're willing to live with that, I think I hear a lot of support for the original bill.
Madam Chair, and that's I think
Rosen?
That's a good recommendation from Senator Marty. I will remove the A3 amendment, or table the A3 amendment, and go back to the original bill. But, Madam Chair, again, this program is broken in many aspects, and I'm hoping that we will come to an agreement to fix this and follow some of the recommendations from the report and. Move this forward, and we have to have a little give and take, because it might be working for the inner city or for the metro. It is not working for greater Minnesota.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, Senator Rosen, you mentioned the report, and I'm in agreement of that. The report really spelled out from the department to repurpose, to look at an overall rate increase, and then to go with a single administrator, which would have been, you know, ready to go. And I'm still not convinced that we're gonna have people out there that might not benefit from this program. And I know you can mix it 50 on one hand, 6 on the other, but I want to make sure that unequivocally we say no one's going to get hurt from what the actions were taken today. And I can't answer that. I would like to, Madam Chair, go back to looking at what the department had suggested we do. So I'm not so fragmented
Senator
anymore.
Hoffman, I think we're all concerned about moving forward with a finite date and not having had the discussion about whether, you know, how we would replace it, how we would replace the program. Senator Rosen, do you wish to reconsider your amendment, and we will vote on that, and then you can withdraw
Madam Chair,
your amendment.
I withdraw the A3 then, amendment.
Okay, first I think we have to reconsider it. Do you move to reconsider? Okay. Does she have to do it, or
she can? I can withdraw it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, I'll move Senator, reconsideration of the
A3 amendment. Thank you. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. And
thank
now,
you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And the purpose is to go to just to heavily and seriously look at the single administrator because of the, you know, the 13 different contracts that they have to do. I mean, this is crazy what we make these providers jump through the hoops. There is one other amendment, Madam Chair and members. It's the A2 amendment.
Yeah.
And that is basically just a placeholder for an issue that came up the other night that we put a placeholder to for a critical access dental clinic up in Alexandria. Senator Ingebrigtsen's provider who is working in the critical access area, but some of the services that that are needed, he has to contract out to other providers. And so there is conversations continuing with the department and this provider to make sure that they get this language right. But basically it says that they need to go into a written contractual agreement to make sure that the CAD the money is delivered to him who can't provide the services, but he's contracting it out. So he's trying to get these folks taken care of, but he has to use outside services to make sure that they're taken care of.
Senator Rosen, can I have you first state that you withdraw the A3 amendment? I'm sorry, just so we move on to the
Madam Chair, I withdraw the A3 amendment.
Thank you. So now we're discussing the A2 amendment.
Yes, ma'am.
Madam Chair, can Council tell us where this should be incorporated into?
Madam Chair and members,
Kavanaugh.
To the original bill now, it would be page 2 after line 33.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I'd just like to speak in favor of this amendment. I know that this would be helpful in other areas as well. I think it will help our providers be able to provide the service that the patients need. And so I will heartily support this amendment. Thank you.
Any other questions or comments on the amendment? Does everyone understand where the amendment is applying and what it does? Did you have another comment?
I'd like to move the A2 amendment, Madam Chair.
All those in favor of the A2 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Any further discussion? I see Mr. Scandrett. Sorry, I don't have your name written down here. Do you have
members,
a brief comment to make?
We just need some time to see how this fits in with the bill. Again, this is new to us, and we, again, want to make sure that no damage is done. We were fully aware the bill is introduced. We're supportive of that bill, but now we're seeing things that are of concern to us. So we would request time to see how this would impact and check with the safety net providers to determine the impact.
Senator Rosen, are you willing to work with Mr. Scandrett before this goes to finance?
Madam Chair, absolutely. I would like to move the A2 amendment. It is just a placeholder, and work is continuing, but absolutely, I will continue to work with them.
We already passed the amendment. I'm just asking if the bill, we'd like to move the bill, and are you willing to continue working with before it goes to finance. Do you wish to move your bill?
Yes. Madam Chair, I move that Senate File 2133 as amended be recommended pass and recommended to finance.
Senator Rosen moves that Senate File 2133 as amended be passed and referred to finance. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
Thank
motion
you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Members.
Senator Eaton, Senate File 2733, Neuroleptic Medication Administration to Persons Subject to Civil Commitment Provisions Modifications. Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if my testifiers. This bill on Neuroleptic Medication Administration is essentially a best practice bill. It requires the courts to make determinations on the need for court orders authorizing Neuroleptic Medication Administration to persons under civil commitment proceedings. It specifies circumstances under which a person can receive the neuroleptic medication without judicial review. And it creates a pilot program to respond to issues related to the commitment notice. And I will let my testifier.
Senator Eaton, do you have an author's amendment?
Oh, I do. I'm sorry.
A1. Senator Eaton has an author's amendment, the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? No, Senator Eaton, did you want to have your testifier explain the bill? For
the record. No, I'm Dr. Stephen Pratt, the Medical Director for Behavioral Health for the Department of Human Services. The first part of this has to do with a very limited circumstance where a person is admitted to a state facility and they have been prescribed antipsychotic medication, neuroleptic medication, prior to admission, and they are willing to take it. But upon admission, the admitting clinician assesses them to lack decision-making capacity. Under current statute, we would have to discontinue the medication while petitioning the court for either a substitute decision-maker or a court order for the medication. This provision would allow us to continue the medication as long as the person is not refusing it until we are able to seek court authorization.
Thank you. Are there any questions about the bill or questions for the testifier? Any further comments, Senator Eaton?
As I said, it's best practice. Otherwise, you have someone starting and stopping and starting and stopping their medication, and it's not in the best interest of the patient.
Thank you. Senator Eaton, do you wish to move your bill?
I will move Senate File 2733 as amended. And I don't know where it goes.
Senator Eaton moves that Senate File 2733 as amended be passed and referred to the Judiciary Committee. It will also be considered for possible inclusion in the omnibus policy bill. Any other discussion? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion passes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Sharon, are we moving forward with another bill? Or Senator Hayes?
Is there one that is a brief bill that we could get out of the way right now?
Yeah. 22.
Oh, it's going to be brief, Senator Hayden?
I think so.
Yes.
We'll see. Senator Hayden.
Good. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I have Senate File 1739. It is an MFIB education program. I will turn it over to my testifiers to describe the bill, and I think that they can get it done.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Jessica Webster. I'm a staff attorney with Legal Aid. And just very briefly, this is really the future of the Minnesota Family Investment Program. This is what the program looked like at the very beginning. We allowed parents to be in adult basic education, ESL, post-secondary education, four-year programs. And this is really returning the program to allow for that those education and training opportunities. And we absolutely support raising the cash grant and doing some of these other things that support families, but this is one thing we can do that will help participants help themselves, and that is having participants pursue education and training rather than putting them in fruitless job search, putting them in unpaid work opportunities that only last a few weeks or a few months. People really should be pursuing their GEDs and their adult basic ed and kind of getting on a career track. DHS has been very supportive of us pursuing this bill, and this really is the future of the program. Thank you.
Thank you. Do you have another testifier who wishes to speak? Please introduce yourself for the record.
I'm Madam Chair and members. I'm Catherine Wagoner with the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. My background is in MFIP employment services, and I can tell you that the workers are under incredible pressure to steer people away from education and toward work, which usually, if you don't have a GED or a high school diploma, means low-wage work. And what I want to get across to folks is that welfare to work is kind of a misnomer, that people who are in the welfare to work program are already workers, except that they're usually churning in and out of those low-wage work jobs. We have a skills gap in Minnesota, and there are great programs out there to fill that the businesses need workers, but these parents are in a program that kind of blocks them from even accessing that training, and we'd really like to look that up.
Thank you. Senator Hayden, did you have further comments?
Madam Chair, I think it's self-explanatory. This is a great bill and a great program for the future.
Members, any questions or comments? Senator Nino.
Thank you, Madam. I was just asking my seatmate here, and he didn't seem to know the answer, so I'm going to on page 3, we're striking some language that has a 24-month limitation for ESL classes. I presume that means we will have students that are participating in more than 24 months. That's the purpose. Where does that funding come from? Is that out of the health budget, or is that out of the education?
Madam Chair, Senator Nino, there is no fiscal note for that provision. Right now there is a five-year limit on TANF, so a student could not be in ESL longer than 5 years. But right now we talked with Adult Basic Education, we talked with ESL, and they have money to absorb students that would be in those classes right now. And sometimes participants are paying for those classes themselves.
Other questions? Council has a technical amendment you wish to offer? Ms. White?
Madam Chair and Senator, on page 2, line 13, and then two other sentences in the bill, references Minnesota adult diploma, and I would like to be able to change that to the appropriate term, which is adult preschool diploma. It's in three places, and if you can incorporate into that.
Senator Hayden.
Madam Chair, I move that we move the language that Ms. White has as an oral amendment.
Is everyone clear on the language that Ms. White is proposing? Okay. All those in favor of the oral amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes. Thank you.
Madam Chair, if there's no more questions of the committee, Hayden. I'd like to move Senate File 1739 for possible...
Senator Hayden moves that Senate File 1739 be passed and referred to Finance.
So.
Thank you. Any other discussion? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion passes. Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I just wanted to indicate that we have announced that we would be in recess until 6 o'clock, but I think that because there are caucuses for both of our groups, that it's probably more likely that we'll be reconvening at 6:30 in this room. So please keep the bills that we have not heard in your packet, And so then what we would do is recess. I'd make a motion to recess until 6:30.
So moved. We're in recess.